Hello and welcome to Gaming Quest episode 432. I'm your host, Mike Apps, aka Wheels. With me as always,
Evil in Residence, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
Hello? Did we lose Gaijin? It's your turn.
Gaijin?
Yes?
I said thing. It's your turn.
What, we already started?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, because I didn't hear anything until you just introduced yourself.
Oh, that's bizarre. That's not good.
Not ideal.
No. No, it is not.
Okay, wait a minute.
How about now?
I know. All I heard was you introducing yourself. I thought, oh, we're practicing.
Oh.
No.
Okay.
I mean, we can turn that into practice. It's been a minute.
Okay. I mean, is Wheels talking?
Yes.
Been talking. Can you not hear Wheels?
I have not heard him. I haven't heard him say a thing since I said hello about 5 minutes ago.
Oh,
that's a problem. Good thing we figured that out now.
Yes. Yeah.
And someone else just joined.
It is Joe.
Yo.
Okay, so you can hear Joe.
Did you or did you not start yet?
I think we're going to restart because we're having technical difficulties.
Okay.
Well, for whatever reason, I didn't hear Wheels at all for like 5 minutes, and then Dave just started doing his intro. I'm like, okay, I guess we're auditioning or practicing now, and I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, let's start this one again as soon as we can figure out how to make you hear Wheels.
Tell him to leave and rejoin.
Wheels is suggesting you leave and rejoin to see if it'll make it so you can hear him.
You know what? He just left.
Jesus Christ.
Hello?
I can hear you now. Okay.
Yay! Right. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
I never had any trouble hearing you.
All right, let's do this. Hello and welcome to Gaming Quest episode 432. I'm your resident Wheel, aka whatever. And with me as always,
Evil in Residence, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
Evil in Rehearsal, your man Japan Michael Baker, Gaiji Mendo Guitari.
And this is Smokin' Joe Gamer, another evil resident.
Noted biohazard.
I am biohazardous waste, yes.
You'll never guess what three of us have been playing.
It's kind of an RPG.
Resident Evil.
Yeah, we'll probably have to be somewhat limited, but...
Why? It's our goddamn show. Talk about anything we goddamn
want.
Yeah,
we are still on RP Gamer. I would like to not waste everyone who's not interested in Resident Evil.
And we still have to answer some questions.
Which might
seem important.
Thank you to our fearless leader, Paws, for donating a eShop code for Fallout 4 for Switch 2 to stream while we record these episodes.
Apparently a better version than the trailer made it look.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is working better than it did when I played it on Xbox years ago.
It is apparently has 30, 40, and 60 FPS modes, which is unusual. And they've committed to fixing what issues people have had with it, so... it looks pretty good. What mode are you playing on?
60.
Oh, well. It looks like it's actually hitting that.
Well, we'll see. We'll see how it does once I get outside the vault.
Yeah. But still, it looks like it's actually hitting that, which is more than I would have expected out of it, because it definitely didn't run at 60 on last-gen consoles.
Nope. No, it did not.
It didn't even run at 60 on Series X or PS5, did it?
I think the new version does.
Okay.
But I think previously it had a frame cap of 30, at least on consoles.
Their engine is like Swiss cheese.
It's very old.
So I played a bit on PS4 Pro and then got the Platinum Trophy and sold the game and then ended up rebuying it on One X, and neither of those versions could do 60. No.
It was legally required that Wheels play this on the basis that he would like to live in a baseball diamond.
Mm-hmm. Well, who wouldn't?
I'm kind of sick of Fallout, but I will play Fallout Boston.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, obviously, if they put New Vegas on Switch, I would play the shit.
I don't think
that.
That's coming to anything ever again because it's just a pain.
But
it sure would be nice.
So, on PS4 and on Xbox and on Steam, there's an achievement. If you kill 100 people, there's an achievement called Masshole. It's great.
That does make sense. But yeah, so for those not watching the stream as we record this, that is what Wheels is playing during this. So if I react to him by saying, "Wow, you suck at this," that's what I'm saying it in response to.
Oh, my intention is to be a gigantic piece of shit and play this game as terribly as possible.
Why?
Oh.
Because he can.
I'm not going to ask. I'm choosing not to ask. I don't need to ask.
I love that janky ass game. I love it.
Why?
I like Skyrim and I like Fallout 4. That's all I can tell you.
Okay. That's fair.
There's a rumor that Starfield's about to hit PS5. If the existing rumor that has also floated around of a Switch 2 version happens, I will be fascinated to see what that looks like. But okay. Before we get into what we've been playing, I want to hit a quick one that we were inevitably going to run into. Which Fireminer has so kindly brought up. Someone used AI to translate Sega Gaga. At least they published the tools they used so that a real translator can do it themselves. But the only time a game that got translated for real after receiving an AI translation was that PSP Suikoden game. Yeah, shame about that game being fucking terrible. But there's been a whole kerfuffle around this. Basically, for those not aware, the quick version is that Sega Gaga was a Dreamcast game that was a parody of Sega itself. It's been kind of a holy grail of please translate this for decades. And someone announced and then dropped a translation and then had like a really mealy mouth back and forth about whether that translation was whether and how much that translation was, quote, I guess we'll be kind and say AI assisted. And there's still a whole bunch of smoke around that. Allegedly, people went over it. It's not clear how much they were given access to the original language files to compare, and people have found a lot of errors that speak to large portions being AI translated with limited editing. There are translation tools floating around. It's the hacking part is largely done. What you end up with is the kind of person who has the pop cultural expertise to actually translate it. That's a whole different story. Okay, I'm surprised. This game is actually... unrelated, but I am surprised to see that this game actually does seem to be maintaining 60 most of the time.
This is, like, rock solid. I don't know. I don't understand how this is working.
Okay, back to this... Sega Gaga is a rough nut to crack for translation, at least in terms of good ones, because it's full of contemporary references and extremely Sega references. You kind of need to know a lot of ancillary information to give a good one. And so you run into just the issue of that, like, if you run that through the machine translator, it's going to miss a lot of things. It's just going to get things wrong, and that loses a lot of the game's core appeal, which is baked into this very specific time where, like, people working at Sega knew that what they were doing was unsustainable. There's some good stuff in there that, like, obviously you don't need a lot of knowledge to translate, but this is not ideal. You kind of have to run into the, like, if they had charged money for it, I'd be really pissed. As it stands, I just think kind of sucks.
I mean, it would be bad enough if they had just tried a basic machine translation, but it's like going with an LLM, that means it's going to be riffing off of itself in ways that don't make sense or make even less sense.
Yeah, the big problem, like, one of the core problems you run into that, like, keeps causing, that makes this so bad is that, like, a machine translation, you run it through, and no one will be able to have illusions that a sentence was correct. Like,
no.
You'll get the gist of it, but you won't think to yourself, yeah, that's probably right. Like, that's probably 100% how someone would translate it. The LLM will translate it in such a way that it can look to someone who doesn't know what they're looking at like it might have been written by a person. But it'll be
confidently incorrect.
Like, yeah, it will be similarly wrong to machine translation. And we've seen that float around a few times for this. So it sucks. The best thing to come out of it is maybe someone gets determined to make something better just because they're so incensed at this. We'll see. Yeah. Another one. A few years ago, I asked about the possibility of Atlas only having enough resources to work on mainline SMT and Persona. Piece of news recently came out saying that Sega shuffled their organization, gave Atlas and Sonic Team more manpower. After Atlas was done with whatever remake, do you think we'll start seeing them resurrecting old franchises? It's going to really depend. Like, we've seen them do some, like, less comprehensive remakes, like the Raido remaster, which I could see maybe being followed up with a remaster of the other PS2 Raido. And, like, given the current state of Yo-Kai Watch and other kid-related RPGs, I'm surprised that no one has bought a Demi-Kids reboot. I don't know how popular Demi-Kids was when it was new.
It really wasn't.
Yeah, like, I think that, like, if you were going to try to strike that market, you'd probably just make something that didn't try to tie itself to something that had failed.
Demi-Kids was trying really hard to be a Pokemon-like in a market that was already dominated by Pokemon, and there were a lot of games in the late Game Boy Color and early DS period that tried this, and very few of them had any sort of success.
Mm-hmm.
Even the ones that were good had very little sort of success.
Yeah, and I think that Demi-Kids runs into this kind of confused market where, like, certainly in Japan, like, the SMT games were aimed at teenagers. But, like, you know, I think that anyone who was particularly attracted to their aesthetics was probably just going to, like, go for the originals. It's not like, I just can't see who Demi-Kids really is for then or now, really.
It was for the shareholders who really wanted a piece of that Pokemon monster collecting action and didn't really understand what they were trying to get into.
Yeah, let me correct. I'm not sure who in the market it's for. But yeah. It's a limited appeal concept.
Well, if you want limited appeal, one of the sequels in that series, Messiah Riser.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real-time strategy game for the Game Boy Advance.
Oh, dear.
How were there more than one of those?
What was the other one?
I don't know, and honestly, I don't know how anyone thought it was playable. Because it wasn't.
I'm sure that's true of both. But yeah, like, I'm trying to remember what other, like, I'm sure there's another, like, GBA RTS I'm thinking of and forgetting, but, like, I know there's more than one, and it's like, why? Whatever. But yeah, I don't think a Demi-Kids reboot's ever really gonna make a lot of sense. just because I think that a precocious child interested in SMT is just going to try to get a hold of SMT, which kind of wraps up into this other...
I was going to say, I can't imagine them attempting something for a younger market that isn't Demi Kids, but
yeah, like
in the same way that they reinvented Persona at one point, and they've reinvented Devil Summoner at least twice at this point.
Yeah, it would kind of, it would just need to be something that, like, if it was Demi Kids, it would be Demi Kids only in name.
Yeah.
But yeah, the follow-up question being, there's a reason why it's either elementary or high school students that are made game protagonists, but how many games are there starring junior high students? I think you find those.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of them don't leave the country, but I mean, yeah. I've...
Outside of like Inazuma 11.
Yeah. Inazuma and Yo-Kai Watch. But yeah, there's...
Yeah.
I mean, Mega Man Battle Network was like 5th and 6th grade. So is Metabots, for the most part. It varies a bit from game to game, but most of those are 6th or 7th grade. There's a lot of games in that general age group, but only a few of the series have ever left Japan.
Yeah, I think it also comes down to, like, a lot of times the RPGs that are school age are kind of like high school will be emphasized as being in high school, and younger than that is just sort of not in high school yet.
Yeah. And it's most often easier to tell just by what they're wearing.
Are they wearing the shorts?
Uniforms. And elementary schoolers don't need to have uniforms necessarily.
So. Good luck.
So series I've played that explicitly had the students in elementary or later elementary school, like what was called middle school in America. I mean, that'd be again like Yo-Kai Watch, Metabots, some of them, Mega Man Battle Network, Hero Bank.
Sure, why not? Fuck it.
Yes. Yeah. The main characters are like 5th or 6th grade in that one, and it's like, okay, sure. High stakes prize fighting online matches.
Listen, the children long for gambling.
Oh, I mean, it's not even gambling. It's. I mean, may have thrown a few fights at one point, but yeah. And probably. Not even the weirdest one, but we also had Choco Vader.
Oh, yeah, you love Choco Vader.
Yeah, it's just hilarious in its own weird way. Very similar to Battle Network in some ways, not others.
Yeah, it looks like Fire Miner's counting like Battle Network as elementary school because they're like, I guess, graduating 6th grade at the end of that one. But
Battle Network is definitely elementary schooler.
Yeah, I do think that that also runs us into elementary school is a big time period, and high school is an important time period. Junior high is a short time period.
Junior high is both a short time period and an important time period because it is the last period of compulsory schooling. Mm-hmm. So by the end of it, you've either decided what you're going to be going into for part-time work for the rest of your life, or you're trying very hard to get into high school. If you have elementary school age protagonists, they're probably gonna be 5th or 6th grade.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but yeah, like as for why games don't often do junior high, I would imagine that it's just relatively short period, less exciting than high school. Junior high schoolers will probably be more interested in a game taking place in high school.
But I mean, a lot of, honestly, if you're going just with this media, most of the Precure series for anime are set in junior high school.
Oh, interesting.
So that means one of the biggest franchises in Japan. Partly so they can feature the uniforms as a component of the costume design. Digimon went from late elementary school into junior high school for like the main protagonists for the anime series. So, I mean, there is, again,
it definitely exists.
Yeah, it exists. It's I mean, it exists about as much as the fifth and sixth graders.
True enough, true enough. I think that, yeah, in this case, it's also just the fifth and sixth graders get localized more.
Yeah.
Probably, and even the, then probably they don't because get localized it's
that little... much, because a lot of times the market is looking at who can we get who will actually buy this outside of Japan, and they're mostly aiming towards a higher age bracket at this point.
But, yeah. Remember when they were bringing over Precure as Glitter Force?
Two seasons, yeah. Or two series.
Yeah, I think eventually they did some Precure stuff that wasn't given an insane new name. But, yeah, Glitter Force always sticks out in my head. It's like, that is quite a name you went with.
I think it was like the two series that got put into Glitter Force were like Yes Precure and Smile Precure, so they had to choose something.
Yeah. Like, you couldn't leave it as Precure. That just sounds deranged, but...
No, I mean, the actual series name, even disregarding the Precure part, was kind of weird.
But, yeah, so... Let's see. But, yeah, I'm going to give us each, like, 3 minutes to talk about what we've been playing, which means that combined, like, there will probably be about 9 minutes of Resident Evil 9 talk.
Uh-huh.
I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock, and do you want to start, Gaijin?
Sure. Okay, so I have a review title I'm working on, which I was probably the only person who originally knew this game existed because I covered it in Japandemonium like 16 and a half years ago.
You and your encyclopedic memory of everything that ever appeared in Japandemonium.
I mean, it's not like I'd remember it immediately, but it'd be like, oh, I definitely remember that title. Let me look this up. And yeah, it was 2 screenshot updates in late 2009. But the game is called Wiseman's World. And it is very much a mid-tier DS game with really pretty sprite graphics, because that's something that the DS did really well for that time period. And they've upscaled the sprites really well, I will be honest. It looks really nice on the Switch. The plot is... It exists. There are characters, there are NPCs, the main protagonist is a blank slate. His little fairy assistants talk more than he does. Which is to say, they talk.
We all know.
Yeah. So this game is not getting many points for story, but it looks pretty, it's got good music, it's... battle system's pretty decent, it's got... It's going to be a solid 3.5, most likely. I'm just kind of surprised that it is popping up on the Switch now after, 16 and a half years.
Yeah, it's just a very strange thing to just see come back out of the blue.
Yeah. I just remember when I saw it was announced, I'm like, I recognize this title. Why do I recognize this title? Looking up, like, seriously?
Now, here? Why?
I have no idea how well this game sold to begin with, partly because I don't think it ever charted on the sales rankings. But I do know I've never seen it in the wild. I've never seen this game in a store that I can remember.
Oh, it's much more available now.
I will double check again later, but I was like, okay. This just sort of showed up. And there are a lot of other games from that time period that I would like to show up as well, so... Here's hoping.
Fingers crossed the first of a flood.
Yeah. It is not a bad game. It's a decent challenge. It's not terribly long. It's looking like probably 5 major levels, and I'm going into the 4th one right now. Right. Now, I would be, except I'm actively pursuing a side quest first, but... So it's... Yep. And, I think... Well, Dallander told me that Wheels played the demo of this last summer, apparently.
We did. I did not care for it.
Yep. So what did you think of the demo back then?
It just seemed confusing and not all that good.
Yeah, okay, yeah. You said mid-tier DS game.
Yeah.
I
mean, it seemed like maybe this game would be better like as a full release. It just did not present itself well as a demo.
Okay. Hmm.
Yeah, like demos can be hard for RPGs.
Yeah, well, what I can say is this is one that it front loads a lot of the premise and most of the game mechanic explanations in the very start.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Lots of talky and eventually get somewhere. And then it doesn't talk for quite a long time.
Yeah, I've seen them like that. Okay. I'm putting...
Resident Evil.
Jesus Christ. I'm putting 3 more minutes on the clock. Wheels, Joe, which one of you wants to go next?
I'll go. Okay, ready, set, go. Okay, so last week I started streaming for RP Gamer again. I took a week off and then came back. And my copy of East 10 Proud Nordics was a little bit delayed, so I played Xenoblade Chronicles X Definitive Edition, Switch 2 Edition, on Tuesday night, and that was fun. And then Thursday I was able to play East 10 Proud Nordics for PS5, and I loved it. So both are great games, and now I've pretty much got streaming figured out going forward. And yeah, so I recommend those two games. And then, of course, I was playing Resident Evil Requiem. So my... deluxe edition with Steelbook just wouldn't ship. As of Friday night, it still hadn't shipped, so I canceled the order and bought it on Steam. And I've been playing...
There seem to be shortages.
Yes, it's a common thing I'm hearing, so I'm like, well, whatever. So I basically saved $20 and got the Steam version, you know, because I didn't get the deluxe edition and all that. And yeah, I've been played for about 5 or 6 hours, and it's great. So I'm playing on... What is it? Classic or no? Standard modern. Yes, I'm playing on that, and I'm doing Leon sections as third person, Grace's sections as first person, as the game recommends. So the goal is to get the intended experience. I'm also just taking my time, fully exploring, saving as often as I feel like. And man, this game is freaking wild. It's, you know, the Leon sections feel a lot like 4. But the Grace sections feel a lot like 7 and 8, and I like the juxtaposition there. You know, switching back and forth makes the game more challenging and more interesting, I think. You know, I would never get bored with the game, but I'm just saying they do a good job of balancing out the two play styles, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And as we discussed, like, yeah, they simplified the crafting system. You just need blood, but... Blood, it doesn't make sense that you mix blood with scrap to make bullets, but it doesn't really have to make sense. It is a good system. And as you said on Blue Sky, like, it just, you have to make tough choices. You have a limited amount of resources, and it all, they all share blood. So it's like, well, gee, do I want more handgun bullets? Do I want more magnum bullets? Do I want, you know, healing items? Do I want the thing that lets me stealth and blow them up in one hit? You know, the syringe thing. So, yeah, a lot of opportunity costs and scarcity, and it's great. You know, I think it really just feels like a true Resident Evil game. I understand why it's getting good reviews. I agree with those reviews so far. And, yeah, just a great game. And, okay, so with the $20 that I saved by just going standard instead of deluxe, I bought Pokemon Leaf Green on Switch 2, and I'm also playing that right now. I just started, and... I restarted 3 times because I just really wanted to beat Gary or whatever his name is at the start of the game. So I picked Bulbasaur, and on my 3rd try, I finally beat the crap out of his stupid Charmander. So
Bulbasaur.
For the record, in game canon, their names are Red and Green.
Okay. Well, to me, they will always be Ash and Gary.
Yeah. Yeah. but let's see. Okay, but yeah, I guess I will drop 3 minutes on the clock and continue the RE9 ranting. So yeah, I picked a. I grabbed the Switch 2 triple pack of 7, 8, and 9. I'm sure that I will have a great time replaying 7 and 8 eventually, but obviously 9 takes top priority. And yeah, it's an excellent, wonderful game. Just self-aware enough to be to cut the tension on occasion, while still mostly being fairly serious in its dramatics. And yeah, like blood is a really interesting thing. Like, it kind of had to be blood because they wanted it to be something that, like, a particularly, like, if you kill an enemy that is by exploding its head, it will drop blood. I think the funniest thing that you can end up making out of blood is steroids and stabilizers, because the only two ingredients to those are an empty syringe and blood. So it's like, well,
it works.
You're just injecting yourself with blood, but okay. But yeah, it's very silly. But yeah, as you mentioned, I'd mentioned on Blue Sky, it's very much just trying to. It's doing a thing where it's forcing stress on the player by giving them resources, which is an interesting thing to do. But yeah, like, I think that they've done a good job of balancing out pursuit enemies. 7 and 8 had varying degrees of focus on that. 7 had a lot of focus. It essentially had only one enemy type other than pursuers. And then 8 like de-emphasized them, but they were still kind of always there. In 9, they've sort of flushed them, beat them back, so that there are only they're a sometimes thing, and that you have a lot of normal enemies to deal with. And I think that's useful because, like, so part of the stress of a horror game is not knowing if you're making the right choice.
Mm-hmm.
And with pursuers, the number of choices is much more limited, and so it's harder to put the player in a position where they're like, am I making the right choice? The right choice is to run away and to hide.
Yep.
Like, that's just how it works. And so, like, it can only ever be an execution question of, did I successfully hide? And if you didn't successfully hide, you're dead, and you might be frustrated now. By putting in pursuers that are less likely, less common, and making you deal with actual enemies, they produce a more interesting question, up to and including one enemy that looks like a pursuer and is in fact just an extremely tough dude. Yep.
So, you mean the chef?
Yeah. Yes. No, I do not mean the chef. I mean Chunk.
Oh, okay. That's right.
But yeah. Since I've just run out of time, I will say also that the Switch 2 version is a technical marvel. I'm mm-hmm. baffled that they managed to make that work.
It's like 25 gigabytes too.
Yeah.
That old black magic.
Yeah. If I can just quickly say that, you know, I did end up getting the PC version, and the RE engine is so amazing, so well optimized. Like, this is the first game where I can actually turn on path tracing without murdering my frame rate. So
reach for the moon, motherfucker. That is what that is what RE engine stands for. Reach for the moon.
Oh wow.
Wow. Cool.
But yeah. Okay. So Wheels, I'm giving you 3 minutes. Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, go.
Alright, we'll start with the Metroid Minute, which is just more Agalos. Where I've gotten the last of the elemental thingies you have to collect. So I think I'm nearing the end of that game. I've also been playing RE9, which I am a chicken, and I am playing it in third person for all.
You're playing it in third person, and you are also just, like, bafflingly aggressive.
Yes. Well, what are you going to do?
I'm just enjoying
yelling at you while you play it.
Yes. Hey, these things happen. I don't know. It's a hell of a lot of fun. I definitely like it. I think I like it more than 8 so far. We'll see. 8 was a hell of a lot of fun. 7 I hated because it scared the shit out of me, and it's an awesome game.
Very spooky.
Yeah.
7 was more gross than scary, I thought.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Fair enough. No.
I do remember playing 7 in VR and watching as a shovel split a man's head in half, so I won't pretend it's not gross.
That sounds pretty awful. Anyway, there's that in review game, which I'll be able to talk about next week.
All right. That's it for me. Neil has been champing at the bit to talk about that one.
Yeah, I can't wait.
That's an awful long embargo time. Okay.
Yeah. We'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Time and place. But yeah. No, RE9, great game no matter what platform you want to play it on. Also, holy shit, bunch of questions just popped in. I think my chat must not have been updating, but now there's a bunch and we have all talked about our games, so let's hit some of these. I asked you last month about the fact that when a market is too used to piracy, it becomes hard to expand into that market and sell things legally. It's what happened to China, because consoles were banned there for so long, a lot of gamers either pirated PC games or played free MMOs. And you had all those gacha games like Genshin with such high production value and low barrier to entry. Some Chinese gacha developers have made single-player standalone games and put it on Steam for cheap. Some Chinese people still complain about the value. It's just that difficult to sell the normal games to them right now. I mean, yeah, we see that in the mobile market all over the world. Like, you can, like, it essentially does not matter how much you're charging. If you were charging something up front, the audience has been trained to say, well, I'd be a sucker to buy that. And it just makes it hard to have a sustainable ecosystem that isn't based around, like, essentially exploiting the user base. But to continue with the question. So in the foreseeable future, the only type of AAA game China is going to make are character action games. It isn't just about copying Wukong. It's about the easiest way to convince Chinese gamers that they are getting $60 worth to pay for it. I don't envy their position. Absolutely not. It's like, and a lot of those, like, I think some of those are going to end up being like essentially flexing, like trying to prove, you know, like, because you saw in some of the like interviews around things like Wukong that there was like some desire to prove that like Chinese developers could make AAA games of that scale. And it's like, I mean, obviously. But, you know, I think that, like, some of the movement into that space will be a desire to show some level of, like, cultural soft power. But, like, you run into this situation where, like, the commitment has to be very strong from some perspective other than money, because, like, unless you're, you know, like, you could make a Wukong and, like, sell 30 million copies. That's certainly enough for anyone's money. Or you could make, like, you know, if you have the kind of money necessary to make Wukong, you could make a free-to-play thing that will vacuum up money forever. I don't know. It's a weird place to be in, not just for Chinese developers, but for, you know, an expanding amount of developers. Like, there are localized versions of this problem when you're dealing with a market that just does not see the value in putting money up front, which is again why the mobile market is very similar. But, you know, it's not unusual. it's not a unique problem to that market, obviously, as mobile shows. And you'll see, like, there are micro versions of that even in console gaming. Like, if you're trying to sell someone a multiplayer shooter nowadays, it's hard to do that because, like, so many of them are like, you're being hit from two fronts. If you aren't constantly updating it, it's like, oh, well, why would I play that? No one's going to be playing it in a month because it doesn't have some sort of like perverse pseudo RPG progression to keep people playing it. even though the pseudo RPG progression makes half that player base miserable. It's just a rough one. But we've seen that encroaching into other genres where you get look at something like, you know, throw out all other concerns about Concord or Marathon. Both of those games are going to have to have had to or are going to have to deal with the fact that a lot of people look at a new multiplayer shooter, and unless it's an established franchise like Battlefield or Call of Duty, if it's a new thing, they're like, why isn't this free to play? And yeah. Okay. Another one. Koei Tecmo is one of the few Japanese developers blessed with a foothold into the Chinese market. It came about not just because of how easy it was to advertise their Dynasty Warriors and Romance of Three Kingdoms games in China. It was because these games were on PC and were pirated so much. Really gives into perspective how much the Japanese game industry missed out on the 2000s when their games weren't on PC. Yeah, I mean, the mid-2000s, like, in the West at least, and probably to a fair extent in Japan, was kind of a dead zone, just because it was easier to pirate than to buy PC games. The anti-piracy measures were draconian. A lot of retailers wouldn't bother stocking them because taking returns was a pain in the ass. Computer players were more likely to be savvy as to where they could get games that were pirated. And those pirated games were easier to run. And their digital distribution had not taken off, so getting them legally by downloading them was probably a huge pain in the ass. So that confluence of circumstances made it difficult to justify being a primarily PC developer in the West. And add all of that to the fact that, in Japan at the time, there just kind of wasn't much of a market for them. What's that?
I was going to say, part of the issue with Japan was that until fairly close to this time period, Windows was not a dominant PC in Japan because of data input issues. So if you look at, for example, PC Engine in Japan, that was rocking for quite a long time.
Or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Through the 90s, you would see Japanese PC games on things like the PC 98.
The PC 98 basically was a PC that was optimized for video games more than PlayStation. So
as far as I can tell, the PC 98 and its ilk were not typically business computers.
But were still a lot of the same.
They were very viable game platforms.
They took a lot of the PC components and were optimized for gameplay rather than business, is the original concept, I think, was.
Yeah, I would put them in the same space as the Commodore Amiga, where they had PC stuff. There was some attempt to push things like the Amiga into the business space. They never took off. It was basically a game machine with a PC interface. Into the 90s, into the mid 90s, Japanese PC gaming was dominated by Japanese PCs. And then it seems like
even until past 2000, literally Windows was having trouble breaking into the general PC market in Japan, partly because of issues with being able to type Japanese.
Yeah. So for a long time, there just is not much of a market that to be built up there. And so what you see is the companies that still made PC games were companies that sort of specialized in genres that the PC was still kind of the best input method for. So you get these complicated spreadsheet grand strategy games.
Yep.
Or things that weren't allowed on consoles because they were things like pornography.
Burgeoning business model there, yes.
Mm-hmm. But those two things kind of keep that market afloat until the problems with using a PC natively in Japanese start to slowly fall away.
Honestly, within the last 10 to 15 years, if that, mm-hmm. the Japanese PC game industry had a very strong inertia going for quite a long time after that. So,
okay, yep. So next one. I've already asked about the line splitting preservation and accessibility, so I won't ask again. But looking at the complaints about Pokemon Gen 1's price on piece, on Switch, that is, for those not keeping up, the Fire Red and Leaf Green Gen 1 remakes in Gen 3 that are $20 each. I've got to ask, at which price do most people think is fair for a retro video game? Can you look at the question from two aspects? How much can people afford, and how much do they think it's worth? Honestly, I'm going to be real with you. If you are able to purchase a Switch, you can probably afford a $20 video game.
Yeah.
As opposed to how much it's worth, I think that's a really sticky question that's affected heavily by how much you emulate things. If you are used to just being able to download these and play them on your computer, then your approximate worth value to this is probably, it should have been in included in Switch Online. I'm sure the official line, if you were to force them to answer the question, would be, well, if we put it in Switch Online's apps, it would not be possible to integrate it into Pokemon Home. That's just not how that emulator is built. Blah, 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 blah. Ultimately, this comes down, but like, and I think they get away with this because it's Pokemon, and people who want to play Pokemon are willing to pay for Pokemon. That has historically been the case. So I think that this gets away with more than something else might. I think $20 is probably a little more than I would have charged for it. I probably would have gone in the 10 to 15 range. But ultimately, I don't think they're going to go broke charging $20 for it. No. And I think some of the outrage is really silly, because the answer is, like, if you think this is too much, don't buy it. Don't buy it. You probably already have this on an emulator with a giant ROM set. These have not been hard to lay hands on, essentially, since they were new. Like, if you think this is too much, like, sure, I can probably agree with you. But it's also going to be just kind of silly. But it's kind of silly to get mad about. And I've seen people get, like, actually mad about. And I would urge this kind of person who is mad to question in themselves, what am I angry at? Because ultimately, that's the most perplexing thing. But yeah, like, ultimately, what you're paying for is a convenient way to access these. And there's some niceties of being able to, if you care about having all of your Pokemon accessible, you want to get them into Pokemon Home, then yeah, sure, you'll do that. But yeah, as for how affordable this actually is, yeah, I would say that, like, if you purchase Switch games regularly, this is not a huge, like, this is not like a completely out there price.
No.
To purchase a video game. Like, if they had, like, had the audacity to charge 40 to 60,
that would be
bizarre.
Right.
They might have still gotten buyers. I mean, it's Pokemon, but yeah. Like, that, then we might have a question of, like, how affordable is this given what they're selling at 20? It's just like, this is probably a little more than I would have wanted, but it's, you know, I could see myself, if I was, like, just really in the mood, then maybe I would do it. But, like, you know, it's $20 is kind of, has been the impulse buy price for games for a lot of regular consumers for decades in the US. Way back in the day, when Sony started up its greatest hits label, remember those? That was nice. I liked having those.
When
Sony started up its greatest hits label, like, greatest hits games were $20. That was the price, and it was supposed to be like, see, this is a big popular game that is available for cheap. And, like, I think that ultimately in the US, like, $20 is a powerful price because it is the biggest,
the largest of... build denomination that doesn't seem like it's too big.
Yeah,
for like that matter, largest... it's the largest build denomination that a lot of physical stores will take.
Yeah, like it's the largest build denomination that a normal person is going to see any given day.
Yeah,
and I think that for the U.S. at least, $20 is a very like psychologically powerful price because it's like it's not nothing, but it's not a ton.
I would just say I just remember a point where on the Wii and the Wii U you could get an NES game for $5, SNES for $8, N64 for $10. I thought that was perfectly reasonable.
I forget how much GBA games were on Wii U.
I think they were $10. Now that I'm thinking about it.
Sounds right-ish.
They were $7.99 or $9.99. Yeah. And then I remember when PS3 first started selling PS1 games, and those ranged between like $5 to $10, depending. Like FF7, 8, and 9 were $10. I think Resident Evil 1, 2, and 3 were $10, but then those were popular. You could get that for those. So it seems like popularity had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, PS1 games were, the base price was $6, and then if they thought they could get away with it, it was $10.
I still think like, that's reasonable, but it's kind of gone up since then, it seems like. But then again, you have PS5 versions of these PS1 games now that are $10 each, but they include rewind, save states, texture filtering, and other things. So I guess it just depends on how much those types of features are worth to you as well.
Yeah, personally, nothing. But
okay.
It's very depending upon your tastes. But yeah, I think that's what you run into. Just like... GBA games, I think, adjusted for inflation, would be around $10 on the Wii U. But, yeah, it's one of those things, like, yeah, I can understand if you don't want to pay $20, but it is also one of those things that I'm going to look at you weird if you're, like, mad.
Well, something I was also thinking about, back during the Wii U period, Game Boy Advance games were much more available in secondhand stores still in Japan.
Yeah, they could kind of nowadays get away with it just because, like, getting a non-bootleg copy of Fire Red or Leaf Green is a pain.
Yeah, no, I mean, actually, the Pokemon games are probably the most readily accessible ones for the secondhand market in Japan. But there's still, it's still going to be more than 2,000 yen secondhand for several of these. A lot more if you're getting Emerald. But just in general, Game Boy Advance cartridges, the secondhand prices have been steadily rising over the last 4 or 5 years. Sometimes ridiculously so. For games I know that aren't that good.
So there's some follow-ups to this that I want to quickly run into. I think that when it comes to kids and people living in developing countries where the classic titles were never released, keeping the price low is a good way to cultivate a fan base. Yeah, moving into... I'm not sure how much Nintendo's trying to move into those territories is the big thing. Like, especially given supply constraints right now, I don't think you're going to see a lot of attempts to push into developing countries right now. Just because the cost of hardware is like, because of fucking AI issues, the cost of hardware makes it so that trying to push into developing countries right now doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah, implementing a discount when you're going to gift the game to someone else also sounds like a good idea. That would be nice, but you can't even gift games on consoles at this point.
No, you can't. You haven't, been able Steam.
You haven't been able to since the Wii? Baffling. The problem is you go to the customers who've been too used to Steam prices and the depreciation of game prices as they aged. I don't think a 20% discount for a AAA game on Steam is even that attractive. People are willing to wait over a year to get an above 50% discount. You charge over $10 for a single 20-year-old game, so those customers are going to complain. Certainly, I just think that, like, I find complaining about price weird simply because the answer is don't buy it. If you think it's too much, don't buy it. Mm-hmm. But we've done that before, but I will not belabor the point. But yeah, I think something that's been interesting to me is that, like, deep discounts on games that are recent have gotten... Like, they've sort of homogenized across console and Steam, where they've gone up on PC and down on consoles. And I think that's ultimately down to the fact that the buying habits of Steam play, like, as Steam player, as Steam has grown more popular, the modal buying habit of Steam players has sort of homogenized to be similar to console players, and the cut that Steam is taking is similar, if not greater. So the kinds of sales that they do tend to have gotten more and more similar over time. You can get cheaper if you go to third-party key sellers, but that's a hardcore player habit. The average person is not going to Game BA to find deals. They are checking to see if Steam itself has a sale.
I also noticed, like, on Kinguin.net, more and more what I'm seeing is you see a really, really low price, and then it's like, oh no, you're buying an account. You're not just buying the game. It's like, well, I don't want to buy a whole Steam account.
I don't even think that's legal.
Exactly. So the game itself, 10% off, 20% off of what it would normally be, but then they also have their own fees that they charge. And again, you get 50% off if you're buying a new Steam account. I'm like, I don't want to do that. And again, that's not a good idea.
What I would say here is that, like, in general, like, when I see deals across PC, console, like, I tend to see from Steam itself pretty similar numbers. You'll see them maybe be a console version might, if it's lagging in terms of the sale, it might be $5 or so more. if they've been on the service for similar amounts of time. The problem with new indie games made for retro consoles too, people egged a lot of developers about selling their new NES or Genesis ROMs so that they could play on flash cards. But the thing is, if you tied the game to a physical cartridge, you've got an anchor to charge over $30. Selling the ROM alone will be difficult to sell it for over $15. Yeah, like, you run into very irrational aspects of consumer behavior when you run into this, and I'm not sure that there's a solution for it because the problem itself is fundamentally irrational. Because it's like, and this is something that I've run into. I remember having this argument back when the Wii first came out and the Virtual Console was, like, being pushed by Nintendo. People were like, how dare they charge for these? They're free on the internet. They're not even giving me a cartridge. And it's like, are you buying, was the plastic important to you? Was that what you thought you were purchasing? I thought that the game was the thing you were purchasing. But there is a certain consumer irrationality that, you know, we're certainly guilty of. Like, I don't like buying game key cards terribly much because there's nothing on them. I can wrap that up in more rational arguments about how, like, it creates an inconvenience. But a big part of that is the ape brain that says there's nothing on this. This is a fake thing. And that there's elements of rationality to that, but some of that is just an irrational dislike. Like, I just don't like that the game isn't on the cartridge. It's silly, but it's there. And I think that, like, that's one of the things we run into. And when you're selling a new game for an old console, you're running into a lot of fairly extreme irrationality in terms of, like, you know, for a normal human being, like, yeah, I will purchase a game that looks old is a fairly, like, okay, there's a lot of different things that might contribute to that. But when you're purchasing, I will purchase a video game for an old platform that has been manufactured in a boutique process to sell it as and to put it on the old console, you're dealing with probably a fair amount of irrationality entirely down the supply chain. Like, the person that made that is probably a little insane. You know, if you've never looked up, say, Paprium, that's my, like, gold standard for the people buying this are crazy, but the person making it is way crazier.
Kid of Star Night. I met the guy who made that one. He's fun. He's very enthusiastic. I'll say that.
I remember looking at, like, the material that was sent out with Paprium for the Mega Drive, and it was just full of truly deranged statements about how only for true fans only the game matters, and then like rambling about the about trying to draw the most power out of the Sega Genesis, and all I could think was like, motherfucker, like the reason no one did this on the Genesis when it was new was that you took longer to make this than the viable life of the platform.
Right. Like,
the Mega Drive was a going concern generously 1988 to 1996. Paprium took like 8 years to make. But yeah, like that's what I'm getting at, is that like when you're trying to sell a retro game that functions on a retro console, you are dealing with irrationality up and down the supply chain. Mm-hmm. Like you're selling to collectors who might not even be intending to play the game, but know that it's a boutique game. If the game becomes popular, then the physical copy will suddenly become very valuable. There's just all sorts of irrationality, and that extends to, well, I just wanted to play an old school style game would be the rational decision, but there's all sorts of like specific identity and nostalgia concept being rolled up into this, which is why people will spend however much money for or get obsessed with this idea of like, finally Donkey Kong Country has been ported to the Genesis as it always ought to have been. Just very strange, like technical, like gigaws, where it's like, it's interesting that you managed to make this. I have no desire to play it. But it's like the desire to produce it comes, the desire to produce it, the desire to purchase it, and the desire to play it are all coming from a slightly irrational place. Like, I don't know if Earthian on Steam sells well when at its lowest the game was still $14. And if you look at Yuzo Koshiro's tweets, it's pretty clear that he and his tiny team did their best on a shoestring budget, and they seem realistic about their expectations of the game. That's the only way for that to survive. You need to be aware that you're making a boutique game, that it will sell to a boutique consumer base, and that you need to create something that works within the budget of what that can possibly return. And since Koshiro has been doing this since the 80s as a guy who worked at Falcom circa East 2.
He's used to this kind of thinking.
Yeah, he's used to working at a company that basically consists of him and his sister.
You really do not get much more boutique than early Falcom.
Yeah, so. Eventually, like he was working there as a teenager along with his sister. They leave to form the company Ancient, which is set up by their mother. And like they're, you know, he is very used to working on small games with small teams. I think that's all he wants to do. Like I don't think he has ever particularly wanted to work on like a large team, anything that, like, I don't even think he would have been super interested in working on a team for like a PS1 or PS2 game that had like 40 people on it. I think that he wants to make small games and small, and that's kind of how you have to be if you want to make this kind of thing work. I don't know how true it is, how much truth there is to the rumor about Sony moving away from PC ports, but considering the questions I just asked, it doesn't sound out of this world. Yeah, there seems to be enough smoke there that I think there's some fire. And the stories I've heard people bandying about in a few places make it sound like it comes down to, well, we thought that everything would sell like God of War 2018 when that came to the PC, and they didn't. And it's like, yeah, that's how that goes sometimes when you port a 5-year-old game. Sometimes people are like, ah, yes, finally. And sometimes people are like, I don't even remember that happened.
Right.
And we keep sort of seeing that. It'll be interesting to see. It does worry me because they bought a company called Nixies, seemingly just to do this. Like, that's basically all Nixies has done. They're currently polishing up the Death Stranding 2 PC port, which hopefully will be quite nice. We'll see. But it seems like that's all Nixies does. So I'm worried for that studio's future. I'm just a little concerned. Just a little concerned. More than one person have told me that if a game is above $50, they expect to be, if not life-changing, then at least able to sustain their emotional and kinetic needs for a good while. Isn't this just unrealistic? I know that there are plenty of good games that debuted at lower than that price, but it isn't because the developers and publishers are happy at that price. They just think it's the best way to advertise the game when they have zero marketing budget. I think it's complicated. I do think that, like, as much as it sucks, there is a need to, like, reach a point that customers are happy with the price on that irrational level. It's sort of like how
I was thinking, if you're relying on a game for like emotional fulfillment and making your life better, there may be other issues involved here.
This is also true, but if we take that in a broader sense and say that they want a game that is that will be memorable and something that they look back on fondly instead of just some disposable entertainment for a weekend. There's some understandable concepts there. But what I would say is that, like, and this shows up time and again, like the push pull of, well, if you don't have $80, you don't have $80. It doesn't matter how much value something has, versus like $80 for, say, Mario Kart World is probably for most people going to get them a lot more value per dollar than most things. Yeah. I pulled out Mario Kart World because that is something that explicitly launched at $80. But yeah, if we're looking at like above 50, video games haven't been 50 in decades at this point. Like, let's just rip that band-aid off. They haven't been 50 since the PS2 died. Or I suppose since the Wii died. But, you know, broadly speaking, well over a decade, and it hasn't been the norm in decades. But in general, like, I think that there would be benefit to games that maybe aren't the biggest thing in the world to considering smaller prices, just by dint of the fact that I think a lot of them could potentially make up prices by volume. But there's limits to that. I mean, you know, like, not every game can, you know, if every game tries to do that, it'll just turn it into the new normal price is $40, and I don't think that you would see a consummate increase in spending, because the other thing you're running into with current games is that a lot of people, you run into that it's a lot of people will play, aren't money limited. There is certainly money limits, but they're not, like, that's not the primary thing that's affecting their decision making. They are time limited. Because there are a million lifestyle games, and the money gets poured into skins that by all rights are heinously expensive for what they are. Mm-hmm. Like,
yes.
You know,
yes.
If you look at how much it costs to buy, you know, tchotchkes, like skins in Fortnite, or like MMO mounts, or like any of these things, like, money is clear, or like to maintain competitive like setups in any gacha game you care to name, money is not something people like to spend, but it's not that no one has it, but more that, like, there we tie back to the discussion we had earlier, where it was that mobile, you know, that, you know, Chinese and mobile players have been trained not to spend. There is a significant portion of the player base that's like, oh, well, I get the game I want for free, and then when I like it, I buy like a $20 skin for some goddamn reason, and then before I know it, I've spent like hundreds of dollars on this, and it's like, I can't imagine doing that for anything. But
yeah,
you know,
yeah, I think the last time I actually did something like that was for Kingdom of Loathing, and that was because the monthly special items actually unlocked extra content, or allowed you to, or provided items that would help unlock it, and you could sell it to other people as well. Mm-hmm. You actually got something out of that.
And, yeah.
I was going to say that I've mentioned this before, but I played Heroes of the Storm over like a 2-year period and somehow ended up spending $200 over that period. Like one day I actually sat down and added up, what did I spend on these skins and on buying the characters, because unlocking them legitimately was too grindy and too time consuming. And it's like, yeah, I spent over $200 over a 2-year period. Oh, it's like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. One of those things where it's like my ideal dream for how these kinds, those kinds of games would work would be that, like, once you had spent a certain amount of money, it's just like, hey, guess what? It's all yours now.
Yeah. Because
we've gotten more out of you in lifetime than.
That's actually how Pokemon Scramble was.
That's how Pokemon Scramble was. Nintendo was like dabbled in free-to-play games a few times, and the way they've always set it up when outside of their phone games, but on consoles like 3DS and shit, they did a few of these, and the way they ended up setting it up every time was, if you spend a certain amount of money, you just get everything. Like, once you spend, like, essentially the equivalent of a full game.
Yeah, that's how it was with Pokemon Scramble, is that when you hit about 3,000 to 4,000 yen worth of in-game purchases, they just unlocked everything.
Yeah, there was a Kirby game on 3DS that did the same thing. Like, it was free to play, but if you spent enough money in microtransactions to roughly equivalent to a 3DS game, you just got everything. There was Rusty's Real Deal Baseball, which I think the maximum amount of money you could spend on that was $40. But the game would essentially, like, ask you multiple times, are you sure you want to spend full price? You can argue him down. You can convince him to sell you it for cheaper. and if you played it properly, I think the game costs like $15. That game is art. I just want to bring that up. As microtransactions go, that game is art. You are playing mini games being sold to you by a divorced dad who is sad, and his children help you to figure out how to convince him to sell you the games for cheaper. It's very strange. when I say that game is art, I'm not being facetious. I think that game is a fascinating use of a fascinating concept for a video game, but also a fascinating use of a pay mechanic as part of its actual mechanics. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it did not become abusive to the player is the reason that I can appreciate it. But, okay. Moving on, since I know that I could perseverate on this for hours. So, next question. You brought up several times about how deck-building roguelikes or Vampire Survivors clones are the most financially viable genre for indie developers. But have you ever thought about what genre has the highest return on investment? I remember someone saying that a 4-5% return for an indie Vampire Survivors clone is pretty bad. Yeah, I mean, like, the part of the reason that these things can make sense it would be that they are... that, you know, especially if they if something is relatively possible to make by a person or a team of maybe 2 or 3 people, then within a reasonable time frame, of course, the ROI tends to be much easier to justify. And so I will say that my biggest reason for why I think things like deck building roguelikes end up happening as much as they do is less someone analyzed the market and decided that there was a need for a 50th of those, and more to do with the fact that the kind of person who has the passion to make a game by themselves or with maybe 1 or 2 other people is disproportionately likely to be obsessed with certain kinds of game design situations, of like the eternal conundrum of the interesting choice that I was just praising RE9 for. But in general, like, this idea of like deck builders and roguelikes are always are built around producing as many interesting choice situations as possible and cutting out as many things that are between interesting choices. And I think that's part of what attracts a lot of indie designers to them, is that they are that there is a fascination with those that is common to the kind of person who would be willing to make a game themselves. Let's see. Many, many people in South America, Southeast Asia, and Africa use Steam Family a lot. They basically use Facebook or local equivalent to find others willing to let them into a Steam Family and play for free. The payment is usually to buy a game for the entire group to play. Reminds me of 80s and 90s anime fans exchanging tastes with each other. Yeah, like the Steam Family share, like I am in a family share with some people that may or may not be family members. And like it's one of those things that like sometimes I will buy games on Steam that I might have wanted to play on something else, but I'm contributing to the group. I think that that's a natural communal thing, especially to allow a lot of people to try a lot of things that they might not have been able to try that way. And it is a value add. It's also definitely something that Valve can only do because of their like extreme control of the market. Like if any other company had such a system, like publishers would simply just not be willing to work with the platform. But because Valve basically owns the PC market and the PC market has continued to expand under Steam, they can't fully say no. It's you're allowed to opt your game out of Steam Family Share, but very few publishers do.
Yeah, but what are you gonna do? Go on Epic Game Store?
Yes.
Yeah, really.
Or are you gonna go EA Play? No. Ubisoft Connect.
But yeah, what I would say is like if I could, I probably would go on Epic Game Store just because like a 12% cut feels a lot less egregious than a 30% cut, but
yeah.
Okay. True.
That's not where my games are, and there's no real way to share them. There's no real way to migrate them. So, yeah, I do think that there is like you know there's always among hobbyists senses of community and trying to allow people to share the things they love. So it doesn't surprise me that people do that. I think in general, there's probably a lot of people in Discord groups that do that. In for a slightly less stringent or slightly less lucrative version of this, I mean, Nintendo's family plans do not care if you're related at all.
I'm on the Ask Wheels family plan.
Hence, it's actually very easy to leave one and join another without the... Like, they don't care. They don't give a shit.
Well, what happened was he took somebody off of his family plan and tried to add me, and it wouldn't work. And I had to reach out to Nintendo support, and I'm like, well, why can't I join? And they're like, oh, no, he needs to call us. So...
Yeah, I left a different family plan and joined Wheels, and I didn't have to call anyone. I just removed me from family, add to family.
Well, that's it. We tried to do that with me, and I thought there was something wrong with my account, and then they were like, "No, tell your friend to call us." And I was like, "Oh, okay."
But evidently, as mentioned, they don't care. They don't care. No,
they don't.
They're not going to try to police you on whether someone is really a member of your family. It's just like if you want to put someone else's account on your plan, whatever, you paid for the family plan. And I think that like among like enthusiasts, that's an extremely common arrangement.
Yeah. So I had a situation a long time ago on the PS3 where I had this friend and he had my password for my Sony account. I had his password. And we did just what you were describing. Like, you know, we would share each other's stuff. But over
people
time...
People did that on PS3 all the time.
Yeah, but over time, he was kind of a shitty friend. And mm-hmm. I kept buying games and he didn't. And mm-hmm. I got to a point where I was just like, I don't... Like, I changed my password and didn't give him the new one. I didn't want to share my account anymore. And he, like, cussed me out, you know. And then at that point, it's like, oh, well, I kind of didn't want to be friends with him anymore anyways. And it's like, well, he's going to talk to me like that.
That's a good excuse.
All right, I'm out. See ya. So, yeah.
Okay, moving on to this next one. If you think about it, the Evercade and the company behind it, I think that was Blaze. That's me editorializing.
I was thinking about Evercade the whole time. You're talking about boutique stuff and putting games on carts, and it's like, yeah, they're selling various collections for $30 to $40, and some of them seem worth it, some of them not so much. And they're just ROMs that Booger somebody Man? Put on a cart for you.
How do you feel about Booger Man?
the pick and flick adventure.
But it runs into the problem of which publishers can ever get a license from. And just to editorialize, the answer is usually publishers that don't give a fuck.
Right.
There have been so many mini consoles, FPGA microcomputers, and the arcade cabinets released in the last 10 years, while companies like Atari, Taito, Capcom, etc. are also more liberal with their arcade catalogs. That runs into the problem they've not getting a real exclusive that elevates it to the average consumer. Yeah, I mean, like, the average consumer was never going to buy this. Collections of weird old console and arcade games, I love them. The average consumer is an enthusiast product, and it's for a specific kind of enthusiast, which is why that wants, like, I just want a game system that I plug cartridges into and it plays them, and I don't have to think about any part of the process beyond those. And it fills that niche. It is good for what it's built for. It seems like the Evercade has lasted as long as it has because Blaze seems well aware of what it's capable of doing in terms of, like, market share, and has not gotten too big for their britches or spent a lot of money trying to get things that, like, people would probably like to see, but which would be too expensive to justify themselves because they just can't really manage to pull enough people in to justify the cost. But yeah, you'll see companies like Atari and Taito and Capcom, and they mostly just like, yeah, sure, pay us, whatever. And for the longest time, SNK would be in that. They might still be in that. I'm not sure how things have been since the Saudi buyout, but in general, like those companies that have like big back catalogs, and, you know, outside of Capcom, big back catalogs but not a lot going on right now, tend to just license their games for like relatively cheap. And with companies like Atari and Taito, you can bring in a big anchor title that people have heard of and care about. Another one of those, like, since I brought up Booger Man, like, Interplay had a whole bunch of, like, old games. They barely even exist at this stage. You'll see that, like, those tend to be the kind of companies that end up on these systems for fairly clear reasons.
I'm at a point where I just got a dock for my Steam Deck and hooked up to my TV, and I have all my emulators and ROMs on there. And it's like, I've been playing arcade and Neo Geo games on there. So I'm like, well, this is better because, like, I don't mind all the extra steps to get that working. And I sync up my DualSense controller. And it's like, at this point, I put away my Neo Geo Arcade Stick Pro because it's this big bulky thing that doesn't have all the Neo Geo games I want and only has 40 games. And it's like, yeah, like, I love mini consoles, but at this point I'm like, you know what? It's so much easier to just emulate on like Steam Deck and also have all of the Switch Online apps on the Switch and stuff. So to me, $50 a year is worth it to be able to play all of these NES, Super NES, N64 games and whatnot on the Switch. And it's fun for me to tinker with the Steam Deck and do all this other stuff with emulation on there. And I was briefly interested in the Evercade, but then I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like thinking about the cost of, like, what's it going to cost you to actually buy all these carts? And it's like they're $30-$40 a piece. And it's like every one of them has at least one game where I'm like, oh, I would want that. But then there's at least one game that's like, what the hell is that? Why would I want that at all?
Yeah, there's always an anchor title if they can manage it.
Yeah.
But to hit the follow-up to this question, I can't help but feel like it can't expand beyond the aging demographic. I think that there's, like, always going to be some, like, people from following generations that are like, I like old things, I'm going to do this. But, yeah, ultimately it's a nostalgia grab. That is the inherent nature of the object. Virtual gamers who actually care about preservation. Thank God that they recently got a deal to publish a bunch of Rare games. Actually, that does remind me that since Microsoft now owns like 30% of all games that were ever important, and they don't give a fuck, they will be very easy to deal with for companies like Blades, who just want to get like a whole bunch of Ultimate Play the Game games and some and a bunch of Activision classics and all sorts of stuff that they that Microsoft owns the rights to, has no interest in, barely is aware they own. Like, all of those put together, you can there are people you can talk to that will be happy to license the IP because it is found money to them. So let's see. A bunch of rogue games, though I don't know if having Banjo as the headliner of the cartridge is enough. And Banjo on a device that doesn't have an analog stick. Yeah, I have no fucking idea how that would control at all. That sounds horrible.
Well, I can give you an idea. I tried to get N64 games running on the NES mini console. And even with the Wii Pro controller with two sticks on it, it's still like trying... obviously, the games didn't run very well at all, but then even just trying to map the controls, even with two sticks, it's like, oh no. I don't even like playing N64 games on like an Xbox One controller or a Switch controller. You know what I mean? I can't imagine. How on earth do you play an N64 game with zero sticks? Oh man.
Yeah, for those unaware of what the Evercade's like actual control setup looks like, it's basically a Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
I have no idea what that would control like. I don't even think it technically really has enough buttons, but I'm sure they had to do some sort of creative mapping, but that sounds hellish.
You know that Tomb Raider collection that came out? Well, they somehow
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, yeah.
They somehow got 1, 2, and 3 at least. Yeah, I think it's the original PS1 versions running on Evercade, and it's the same. Like, yeah. I don't know if that controller had sticks or not.
It doesn't.
To begin with. It's like, whoa, what? So right now you can buy an Evercade bundle that comes with the Tomb Raider cartridge, but I'm like, I don't think I'd want to play that on there.
I mean, I'll be fair. Tomb Raiders 1, 2, and 3... were essentially made before the PS1 DualShock had any sort of mainstream purchase.
Okay.
So what you're really missing out on is two shoulder buttons. You can get away with that with Tomb Raider 1 through 3. Honestly, okay. You'll be playing them on a better D-pad than you were on the PS1.
That's true.
But yeah, like, yeah. Okay. But let's move on. Last week I asked about putting a game with social sim elements in an extreme environment setting. With the unveiling of Pokemon Wind and Waves, I just have got to ask, what kind of environment and climate makes you want to go out and explore? Like, be real, how fun is it to walk through a desert? Like, yeah, I mean, the problem with the desert is lack of landmarks. That's, like, seeing what's new on the horizon is a big part of, like, making a game world fun to explore. And a world with nothing on the horizon but dunes is not fun to explore.
I was going to say my least favorite video game setting tropes are desert, poison swamp, and sewer. And I don't know why so many games have them.
None of those have great landmarks. No. Sewer, the answer is a limited amount of asset creation.
Okay.
You can make sewer about as large as you need to or as small as you need to. And you need basically two tunnels worth of assets.
Okay. Gotcha.
It for early 3D games, it was also a way to force the game to have especially for early 3D games, you also got the benefit of you can always tell where the player is and how many places they can go from there. So memory management is easier, performance optimization is easier.
Interesting.
Yeah, they're like tunnels in general are really useful if you just want to make guarantees about what the engine has to be able to do. Like, that's why, you know, you look at, say, Crash Bandicoot on the PS1, and part of the reason it looks so good is that, like, Andy Gavin was a very talented programmer, but part of the reason it looks so good is that there's only so many places Crash Bandicoot can go from any given area. But yeah, let's see. But yeah, like, give me cool landmarks, give me varied things to see. Like, you know, part of the reason I ended up liking Scarlet and Violet so much is that there were a bunch of different kinds of places to see, and it looks like Wind and Waves are going to do that as well. I just realized we all need to say what starter we're going to be picking in Wind and Waves.
Fire Dog.
That's a Pom Bon.
Yeah. I mentioned this in the channel, but last Saturday I met Pom Bom's like real life stunt double. This 13-year-old Pomeranian, fluffy as heck, just needed a little extra orange hair dye. It would look exactly like this Pokemon.
Nice.
Yeah. Very friendly little guy, too.
Oh, yeah. They are, like, Pomeranians are enthusiastic dogs.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, I love Pomeranians. I've seen a lot of people comparing him to Pom Bom to Missile from Ghost Trick. Who, if you've never played Ghost Trick, please go play Ghost Trick. He is an enthusiastic little Pomeranian who is who's doing his best, but is also just dumb as rocks. I love him. Yeah. So, because like one of the first times you see Missile in Ghost Trick, I need to briefly give some context. One of the first times you run into Missile from Ghost Trick, he is like, "I need to go out and help people. I need to get through this closed door." And then you just see him like repeatedly running and jumping, trying to reach the doorknob and slamming his head into the door. Everyone should love Missile. Let's see. Tiki Party says this channel is so varied. Thanks. There's so many people all the time. Thanks for streaming. Thanks, Tiki Party.
Thank you. Thanks for watching, listening, whatever.
Okay, so Fireminer asks, how did people feel about Pokemon XD back in the day? I forget that it exists all the time. I think, it's a pretty late GameCube game. Like, I want to say in the US it might be like early 2005.
Yeah, I didn't know it existed back then. I didn't even know what it was. Yeah,
so it's kind of a sequel to Pokemon Colosseum. I'm kind of surprised that they're not doing both.
Huh.
It's a late 2005 GameCube game, and by that point it was pretty clear that, like, things were basically over for the GameCube. Like, third-party games weren't really coming out. Twilight Princess had been delayed out of 2005. There just was not a lot going on for the system, and people weren't paying that much attention. It's an interesting game, but it needs to be, like, when you see people talk about, like, it's a Pokemon RPG for the GameCube, it's like, yeah, it's a Pokemon RPG in the GameCube that has, like, two towns and four dungeons. It's a pretty limited game. It's neat. There's some interesting ideas in it, because you're, like, the only Pokemon you can get in it are very limited, because you have to steal the shadow Pokemon of other trainers, and those are the only Pokemon you can get, except for, like, five spots that allow you to catch wild Pokemon, and each of those only has like one or two Pokemon you can actually get there.
Okay,
so like it's a very limited set of Pokemon. It's kind of neat. Like, it has an interesting atmosphere. It has like it's set in the Ore region, which is kind of a like I don't even like it, it's less obviously based on one specific place than
I remember hearing it was described as like Pokemon Arizona.
Yeah, Arizona is probably the closest thing you'll get to it. It does have elements of the American Southwest, but it has some other stuff in there that just sort of like, this is just a JRPG town. I don't know what to do with this.
Okay.
So, but it's kind of neat. Like, I think that a Switch Online expansion pack is probably an ideal place for it.
Sounds like it.
Because you can pop into it and kind of dick around with it, and you're not spending full price. But it was also like, it needs to be understood that, like, it was also clear that Pokemon Gen 3 was on its way out, and this was kind of the last Gen 3 game that existed to get you the last handful of Pokemon that were just impossible to get in the Gen 3 games because they were random ass Johto Pokemon. And so, like, the big deal of XD is that you can get a Shadow Lugia, and that, like, there's no way, there's basically no other way to get Lugia in those in the GBA games. So if you wanted to get Lugia into your like Ruby, Sapphire, Emerald, Fire Red, Leaf Green cartridge legitimately, you had to purchase this video game, finish it, capture the Lugia at the end, purify it as a Shadow Pokemon, and then send it via the GameCube Game Boy Advance Link cable. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. It was also known to be sort of like, at the time, it was like, oh, it's another Pokemon game where that mostly exists to fill out the Pokedex. Like, I've mentioned it before, but there has never been a time when it felt more abusive to try to fill out the Pokedex than Gen 3. Just because of how many Pokemon ended up locked in GameCube games.
Because of the issues with backwards compatibility trading to the Game Boy Color games, too.
You could not trade from Game Boy games up to the Game Boy Advance games, like, absolutely locked out. And so what that meant was that Pokemon, like, instead of putting all those Pokemon into Ruby, Sapphire, Emerald, Fire Red, Leaf Green, a lot of the Johto Pokemon got shunted over to the GameCube games, and so, like, getting them was just an enormous pain in the ass. So yeah, at the time it was like, okay, like it was the time where people still want to be playing Gen 3 Pokemon was kind of over. The time that people were still buying GameCube games was kind of over. It's a well enough liked game. It sticks out less than Colosseum because Colosseum's got, like, it's sort of an edgier game where you're playing as an adult, and like XD kind of retreats back to, oh, you're playing like a 13-year-old. So, like, it doesn't have the edge appeal that made that one memorable. And that one came out earlier in the GameCube's life, so that one's more remembered. XD is kind of like, because it's so late, like, it's well enough liked, but it's not well remembered. I've made fun of the fact that so many indie studios were all into the roguelite deck building Gold Rush, but then those games are turn-based. Are there so few studios who try to do a deck-building action RPG like Battle Network or Chain of Memories? It's because they're too expensive to make. I don't think they're expensive, but I do think that they require a different kind of expertise. And that you're going to spend a lot more time in the... There's probably additional expense in that you're probably going to spend a lot more time in the actual prototyping phase instead of the paper prototyping phase. Like, if you're looking at something like, if you're looking to make a deck builder roguelike, you can kind of prototype that on paper. Like, if you have a bunch of index cards, you can prototype the game flow of a roguelike deck builder. Like, that is possible to do. Whereas, like, if you're doing an action version of that, you can get, like, elements of the balance worked out in a pile of note cards, but you can't. You're going to have to iterate on the actual feeling of moving around, and so you're going to spend a lot more time in the prototyping phase, in terms of, like, the technical prototyping phase, I should say. And I think that a lot of what attracts developers to that genre, that makes certain kinds of indie developers fascinated by it, also makes them, like, they're less interested in aspects of nailing certain, like, minute elements of, like, action game feel. Would KH1 be better had it ended right after Sora saved Kairi and Kairi saved Sora? I mean, like, it would have made it less, like, obviously sequel bait, but I mean, like, I kind of liked that it has, like, that sort of bittersweet element of, like, these two and Riku too, like, all three of these characters absolutely need to get back together, but, you know, for now they have to be apart, and that's kind of sad, and personally I think it makes it more memorable. So like, personally, I don't think so. When Kingdom Hearts 2 Final Mix originally came out, did you import it? Yes. Not right when it came out, but when I got a Japanese PS2, it was the first thing I imported. because Kingdom Hearts 2 Final Mix has critical mode, and that completely turns the game on its head. I don't know if anyone else here ever played it, but for those unaware, critical mode is, it takes Kingdom Hearts 2's hard mode, and it caps the amount of HP you can get by level up or whatever by about... Wheels, did you somehow save yourself in the middle of dying?
Yeah, it auto-saved me into the middle of dying.
That's that old Bethesda black magic.
Wow.
Incredible.
What an incredible piece of shit.
But, yeah. Sorry, for those not watching the stream, I was just watching Wheels trapped in an infinite loop where, like, he was... just constantly ragdolling into death, and I wasn't sure what was happening.
Jeez.
But yeah. So for those not aware, critical mode, what it did was it made it so you were stuck on, you were playing in hard mode, and you could not, you had a max HP that capped out at about a third of where it would in a normal playthrough. But in exchange, you start with 50 ability points, which is like, you know, dozens more than you would normally start with. And you start with a bunch of abilities. And what critical mode forces you to do with Kingdom Hearts 2 is it forces you to play the game more like an action game, to understand how the action works and to see that, like, the action in Kingdom Hearts 2 is good enough that you can just play it like an action game if you're good enough at action games. So... that's why I imported Kingdom Hearts 2 Final Mix, because of that mode. And it's okay. Really good. It's a lot of fun. I recommend it. It's in all of the modern ports of Kingdom Hearts 2. Okay.
We should probably start wrapping up. I am fading quick. Let's make this the last question.
Okay, I'm gonna hit these Kingdom Hearts questions real quick. I don't keep up with the Kingdom Hearts fandom, so how much did people complain about the existence of the Final Mix version? They didn't complain about the existence, they complained that they couldn't get it. The phrase anti-consumer had not yet entered internet people's heads, so no, that phrase did not come up. It was just people being like, why won't they let us have it? I want to buy it. Okay. Birth by Sleep was originally meant for the PS2, right? Unclear. There have been conflicting statements. Why didn't Square Enix change the target platform to PS3 instead of the PSP? The team assigned to it was not large enough to make a PS3 game. Like, the Kingdom Hearts 2 team had been moved to Versus 13, and then almost immediately after that moved to 13 because 13 was spectacularly late. So they had a smaller team sized for smaller games. And it was like, I would presume, like, when the question of what platform to make it for came up, the answer was, well, it doesn't make sense to try to make this team is not large enough to make a PS3 game, so we should not try to make them make a PS3 game.
Was 13 originally going to be a PS3 exclusive?
Yes.
Okay.
Like that's what it was announced as in like 2005.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Had they always intended 2.5 Remix to contain Birth by Sleep? Like, I'm sure that when they were making the collection, the intention was always to have Birth by Sleep in it, which is why it has it. Will Kingdom Hearts 4 finally tell us what's in the box? No. Do you think Kingdom Hearts 4 will be the end, or is there enough plot leads left for another game or two? I'd suspect there will be probably at least one more game after Kingdom Hearts 4. They never did plots that were resolvable in one game. There's like three different mobile games that are leading into Kingdom Hearts 4.
Yikes.
Yeah. Okay, so as much as I'd like to answer the rest of these questions, sorry, Fire Miner Wheels is dying, so thank you for the questions. I will quickly do our spiel about where you can ask questions, and then we will do some plugs. Okay, you can ask us questions via the Twitch chat. If you go to twitch.tv/rpgamer or twitch.tv/askwheels, somewhere in the neighborhood of 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Mondays. We sometimes start a bit early so that Wheels doesn't die. You can also watch our sister show Shenanigans, where me, Wheels, and Joe play something, sometimes together, sometimes we're just all playing the same thing. But that's at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays. You can also ask us questions by going to the RP Gamer Discord, which you can join by going to the community tab of RP Gamer and clicking on the Discord link there. If you put questions in the podcast section, we will be happy to answer them. We might start also putting out question calls on Discord or Blue Sky at some point in the near future. If you wish to ask Wheels on Blue Sky, yes, I'm trying to make your life miserable in particular. If you add him on Blue Sky with those questions at askwheels.bsky.social, then we'll add those to the question count as well. Otherwise, you can also ask us questions in the comments section under this very episode in on rpgamer.com. We usually check the last three or so episodes to make sure that we didn't miss any. But otherwise, that is all you need to know about asking us questions. Tell me where I can get books, Gaijin.
Well, as always, unfortunately, Kindle is still the main game in town. So if you enjoy tabletop role-playing games, if you enjoy witnessing other people playing them, and honestly, this is, as always, a whole thing, then we have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. I am almost halfway through writing the 15th episode, which is going to be the capstone of the main plot line. Figure out what happens after that. So the time this is finished, it will probably be about the same length as War and Peace. I made jokes about that at one point in the series.
Yeah, I remember. And then you made good on those traps.
Yep. It's like, I mean, it's not quite the same as the joke, because the joke was like one of those middle school series that attempted to outdo War and Peace for length in 50 easy installments, and this is going to be about 21. But with one of those being very long. So eventually 15 episodes, 5 side stories, and a really long paralogue. Just for fun. So, among other things, we have, Lit RPG, Vainglorious Long as the Night. This is all by under the same pen name, Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. So Lit RPG, Metroidvania, lots of B-movie references. Probably deserves its tongue-in-cheek warning sticker in the corner, so feel free to check that one out. And folklore, Japanese animal stuff, we have Tanuki as a Teapot, Japanese folk tales about animals. Animal-related, somehow animals are in there. Just lots of fun. And what else here? And then finally, or I'm losing track. There's too much stuff at this point. then finally, under the other pen name, Michael Spearwater, Spearwater. We have A Wager for Wanderlust, which is travelogue, romanticy, a lot of different things that I don't really want the young adult fantasy demographic to be crossing over with by accident, but if they happen to be looking up my first pen name. So it gets a second pen name. And then soon-ish, at least one more, possibly two or three more books under that pen name. The next one coming up the date's going to be in April, just randomly chosen there. It's called The Sin of Tantalus, which is, how do I describe this? Zombie-adjacent social distancing dystopia.
Damn.
Yep. Basically, wow. I really don't like zombies as media, normally. Listening to you guys is about the closest I'm ever going to get to experiencing Resident Evil.
That's fine.
yeah. I do like reading up like the summaries of these games to find out why or how they think a zombie epidemic is supposed to work. So this next book coming out does not function the same way as your normal zombie epidemic, but it uses a lot of the same tropes and
Also, considering the fact that I wrote this thing in 2018, like almost about 2 years before the pandemic, and it's a lot more pertinent now than it was when I wrote it.
Oops.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm not sure how I did this, but you know what, go me. Is the basic point being that there is basically an epidemic going on, and it is not affecting enough people for the main public to really be concerned about changing anything about their lives to help deal with it. And so the main character is just kind of having to live with this issue and trying not to get eaten at the same time.
Ditto.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that one's coming out in April. I will be plugging it more.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, thank you. I should probably be quiet now.
So, quick, lightning round. Where can we find you?
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, I am a streamer for RP Gamer, which is the channel you might be watching right now. So on twitch.tv/RPGamer, on Tuesday nights around 10 p.m. and Thursday nights around 9 p.m., that's Eastern time. For the foreseeable future, I should be streaming East 10 Proud Nordics, although I may occasionally sneak a different game in there. So that's mainly what I'm doing now. I just participated in an RP Gamer feature for the first time in years, and it was about Pokemon. So hopefully that's coming out soon, and we can talk more about that.
I think that's up.
Yeah. It might be up already? Oh, great. So yeah, check out RP Gamer, because I'm trying to get back into like feature writing. So
I was
that's
in
fun.
That article, too.
Hooray!
Yeah, those big group features are always a fun way to talk about.
Yeah. And I want to say this Saturday, I think we're doing the Game of the Year podcast, and I was invited to be on there, so that should be fun.
Oh, yeah.
That's always a good time. You're going to have fun.
So beyond that, you can look me up on Blue Sky, Joey at smokeandjoegamer.bsky.social. And you can also go to my YouTube channel under Smoke and Joe Gamer. And I've got a whole bunch of videos there. I haven't done a new video in maybe 2 months now, but I have some ideas, and maybe I'll feel like making videos again at some point. So yeah, please consider liking, following, subscribing, whatever the contextual thing is. Thank you very much.
Okay, that gets us all out of the way. So in the interest of preserving what's left of Wheels' mind, see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
This is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you.